year marks the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, and today the 150th anniversary of the firing of the first shot at Fort Sumter. This hour of the program, we speak with the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. And he writes, Adam Goodhart, early in the book, that this book is a story of how some people clung to the past while others sought the future, how a new generation of Americans arose to throw aside the cautious ways of its parents and embrace the revolutionary ideas of its grandparents. The battleground of that struggle was not one orchard or wheat field, but the quickly growing country itself. Adam is a historian, a journalist, and a travel writer. He's a regular columnist for the New York Times Civil War blog, Disunion, which I highly recommend that you visit during this sesquicentennial celebration, as well as for the next few years. He is the Hodson Trust Griswold Director of Washington College's CV Star Center for the Study of the American Experience. He has written for National Geographic, Outside, Smithsonian, The Atlantic, and the New York Times Magazine. We will be welcoming phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Adam Goodhart, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen. That music was terrific. You know, I was expecting like an artillery salute at the end of it or something like that. It was wonderful. It gets the blood racing on a Tuesday morning, you know?
I was just reading a novel about Gettysburg because we're just back. We took some listeners to Gettysburg in Washington, and that day is still with me. But I was amazed to know that music was a big part of many of these battles, too. People would sing before, and there's a whole bunch of Civil War music that was very important, so we thought we would start with that. But I can see why they used it, right?
Yeah, it was the last American war where bands went into battle with the soldiers. Kind of amazing to think about now.
Yeah. Well, let's start right off with slavery. Men and women at that time, you say, on both sides of the conflict, and of course your book talks about this in some detail, what was happening in the months before the Civil War started, what was happening with Abraham Lincoln and with members of various political parties. Both sides of the conflict did understand it as a war against slavery even before it began. That is clear, you say, from what they said and from what they wrote.
That's right. And that's true, yes, of Americans in both North and South. It's interesting because that perception has really shifted today. In fact, just sitting here in the studio waiting to go on air, I was looking at a brand new study that just came out from the Pew Research Center where they interviewed Americans now about what they thought the cause of the Civil War was. And 48% said that it was mainly about states' rights. And
oh, my gosh.
38%, yeah, only 38% said it was mainly about slavery. And that's North and South. So it just goes to show how different, I think, perceptions are today really from what they were at the time. When you read what Southerners were saying, what Northerners were saying, and I could share some of that with you, it's really clear.
Yeah. Tell me about, this is one of the more remarkable findings that you made, and I'm with you. A lot of people want to understand what happened with one group of fighters and another group of fighters and where the battles took place.
That's right.
To me, it's a story of brother against brother and North against
yes.
South and the Civil War and the enormity of this event. You and some of your students found a whole pack of letters fairly recently that looked at that very human question of how can I fight my brother? What side am I going to be on?
Yes.
Can you talk about that? I thought that was a remarkable discovery.
Yeah, it was just a remarkable case of serendipity that led me into this book and led me into that incredible moment of 1861. I live on the eastern shore of Maryland, which is an area that's got a lot of incredible old colonial towns and plantation houses. And I always take my history students into these places to explore. And so we were exploring an old crumbling plantation house that's been the same family for 13 generations, if you can believe that. And in the attic were just literally boxes and baskets of family papers. And to make a long story short, one of my students who was very interested in military history, he himself is a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, wanted to find out about the family in the Civil War and wanted to dig through these papers with me. And I said, well, Jim, you know, it's a lot of papers and it spans three centuries and we may not find exactly what we're looking for, but we start digging in and pull out, one of the first things we pull out is a bundle of letters, and it's all tied up in a silk ribbon that clearly hasn't been undone in more than a century.
Like, oh, my God.
Yeah, it was just, you know, and written on the outside was the date 1861, and I just turned to my student, and I said, Jim, you know, it isn't always this easy for a historian. And we unwrapped it, and there inside this bundle was an incredible, incredible story that just brought that moment to life for me. And it was about a member of this family from the plantation who was a U.S. Army officer stationed out in remote Indian territory in the West. And as the Civil War opens, he's trying to figure out what to do, whether he should go with the North or with the South. And he was tugged both ways because this man had been serving under the Stars and Stripes since he was a 14-year-old cadet at West Point. So he was loyal to his country, to his flag, veteran of the Mexican War. On the other hand, he felt like he was a Southerner. He was from a slaveholding family. He was close friends with Jefferson Davis. He'd been at West Point with Robert E. Lee. And he's also thinking, you know, just in terms of self-interest, if I join this cause, I may end up as the founding father of a new nation, much as the Patriots of 1776 were. He's writing to his wife, he's writing to his brother, and trying to figure out what to do, and his wife writes something that I love. She said, it is like a great game of chance, which is exactly how it was, and it just brought that moment to life for me, and I realized that the Civil War wasn't something that was just fought on a few battlefields, but actually within families and even within individual hearts and minds. You know, that stuff about whose cavalry went charging over which hill against whose infantry kind of makes my eyes glaze over, but this, to me, just brought a very human story to life.
Yes, it certainly does. Well, let's talk about this day for a moment, and to look at this day, we have to look at the months before this day, and to look at this day, I was fascinated by what you wrote about Major Anderson talking about people who have different kinds of paths in life and what his background was, which made him, you know, an unlikely important participant in the Union cause. Maybe he could have gone either way, maybe not. But talk about him and about the months before what happened today at Fort Sumter.
Yeah, Major Robert Anderson was the commander of this little Union garrison at Fort Sumter, a two-acre island sitting in the middle of Charleston Harbor. And when you say garrison, it was hardly a military force at all. It was 60 soldiers and a brass band, literally.
Oh, my.
But this tiny little place, it sort of became the sand in the oyster of the Confederacy. They just couldn't bear to have it there, right at the epicenter of secession, Charleston, South Carolina. And so they basically ended up besieging this little force with thousands of Southern volunteers who gathered, who sort of ringed the harbor with artillery pointing at this little island. So this commander, Robert Anderson, becomes very unwillingly sort of the key player in this entire national crisis and the person in many ways on whom peace or war will turn. He himself is a Southerner from Kentucky, from a slave-owning background. He sympathizes very much with the South, and he also hates war, and the last thing that he wants is to initiate a conflict between the two sides of his country. But in the end, he is really forced to be the Union hero of this first battle of the conflict. He's sort of maneuvered into a point where he has to fight for the Union. He has to open the guns of Fort Sumter on his fellow Americans, of course, in response to the Southerners firing the first shot. So there's just sort of irony upon irony and many complexities in this story that I think have been lost. The full drama of that moment has been lost through the years.
And I was struck by his trying to communicate with the War Department in Washington, and it seemed as though these people at Fort Sumter were just kind of left hanging.
That's right. Yeah, they're there on this island. They're incredibly isolated, and it's very surreal for them because they're just waiting for orders for months and months from Washington, and the orders aren't coming. And they assume that, you know, their post is of no military value at all. They're going to be withdrawn at any moment. They literally start packing up and doing things like there's a Union officer who's borrowed a mustard spoon from a Confederate officer over across the harbor, and he writes this guy saying, well, let me send you back your mustard spoon. So, you know, as a historian, I love when those really sort of human moments come to life in the documents. And then suddenly an order comes from Washington, comes from Lincoln, saying an expedition is on its way to you, and please hold on until this expedition is able to arrive. And so suddenly it's this sort of, oh my gosh, moment. We're going to have to defend ourselves, because of course the Confederates decide not to wait until the expedition comes and instead to open fire almost right away and begin the war. And at that moment, everything changes in American history. Everything changes in the course of the war, certainly, because it becomes sort of what I call America's first 9/11 moment, or Pearl Harbor moment, when there's a sort of a great national trauma that's experienced almost instantaneously all across the country, and that just galvanizes public opinion, rallies this sort of previously divided North together to fight for their country, to fight for their flag. And it was the biggest mistake that the South could have made. I think in firing that shot and winning that little two-acre fort, they may very well have lost the war.
Mm. And talk about, I was not aware of the hope for and the actual negotiations that were going on for some kind of compromise here. Was there ever a chance of avoiding all of this?
Well, I think that it was very hard to avoid secession by this point. It was going to be very hard to avoid the Union splitting up. But in fact, there were millions and millions of Americans, probably the majority of Americans, fell somewhere in the middle, as we Americans tend to generally in our politics. But also, as sometimes happens in American politics, not that we see any of this today, the radicals on both sides end up controlling the agenda. No, I can't think of anything. And I think that's actually part of our ongoing fascination with the Civil War, that we see these echoes of current-day politics, that in American democracy, we always sort of feel like we're on the verge of civil war. We're always fighting one another. We use this language of fighting for what you believe in, of a political campaign, this sort of military word. And so there's a sense that we're always at each other's throats and things are about to spill over into something worse. And I think that's part of why it resonates for so many people today.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. And Adam Goodhart is our guest. He is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Today marks the 150th anniversary of the first shot being fired at Fort Sumter. I feel like we have to pause and take that in. Very momentous day in American history. And he writes about 1861 and what was happening in terms of different points of view, and what was happening to human beings all over the country, what was happening to the future president of the United States, to political parties, to demonstrations that were going on. He looks at this year, such an important year in our history. To your phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our guest is Adam Goodhart. And we also want to tell you that he has been doing a terrific blog, Disunion. If you go to the New York Times, you can Google his name. But Disunion is the name of the blog in which he, for some time now, will continue to do his writing a daily account of what was going on in the Civil War. And he's also going to be hosting a live chat on NewYorkTimes.com immediately after this interview. So that will be interesting as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Adam, and let's start with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Eugene.
Good morning. There was a Cherokee in a black community that was settled in the 1850s above Lafarge. And out of that community, there were four Rebels brothers that were Cherokee that fought for the Union Army. And one of them, Henry, fought 30 different engagements, everything from Gettysburg to the Battle of the Wilderness to Cold Harbor. And he was at Appomattox Courthouse when Lee surrendered. And his brother, Aaron, was in the company that captured Jefferson Davis. And also for the Wisconsin, there was a colored unit, the 29th Infantry, that fought for Wisconsin. And if you're going out of Hillsboro on 33 toward Wildcat Mountain State Park, The Rebel Cemetery is on the left-hand side going up the hill, if anybody's interested, pretty much. But there was also the Drummer Boys. There was a drummer boy named Samuel Arms, and I think he's buried up at Burr Ridge. He survived until about 1909, 1910, pretty much. That's about all I have.
Thank you, Eugene, so much.
That's just fascinating because I think a lot of people, certainly in the rest of the country, lose sight of the fact that places like Wisconsin, places that we don't usually think of as sort of central parts of the Civil War story, were in fact incredibly, incredibly important. I think a lot of people today think about the Civil War as something that you can go to a few national parks in Virginia and Pennsylvania and Tennessee to visit. But in fact, places like what was then known as the Northwest, Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota, were key places in the outbreak of the Civil War. This was the sort of the what I call the Deep North, a place that was as radically pro-Lincoln and in many cases as strongly anti-slavery as the Deep South was radically pro-slavery. And the balance of power in America was shifting to places like Wisconsin, and that was a big part of what struck fear into the hearts of the South.
Tell me more. You talk about this in the book, of how black people in this country were able to help fashion their future.
Well, you know, we typically, I think in traditional American history, we think about these slaves who were toiling on cotton plantations, and then at a certain moment, midway through the war, Lincoln signs the Emancipation Proclamation, which starts this process of setting African Americans free. Well, to me, one of the most remarkable stories that I found in writing my book is the story of how, in fact, right in the very first weeks of the war, before any major battle was fought, African Americans began all through the South to seize their own freedom, to undermine the Confederacy, and to support the Union cause. Almost as soon as they could, they began escaping from the Confederates, who in many cases had actually forced them to go and work for the Confederate Army, doing the manual labor for the Confederate Army. And they start escaping and going into the Union lines and forcing the North to sort of confront this reality of African Americans freeing themselves. And before long, it was thousands and then tens of thousands and then possibly even hundreds of thousands of slaves doing this before Lincoln ever signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And my favorite story of this is that when Lincoln finally does issue that proclamation, that day in Washington, William Seward, the very canny Secretary of State, is crossing Lafayette Park, and he runs into a Union officer, and the officer says to him, congratulations, Secretary Seward, on this great deed that the administration has done today. And Seward sort of snorts, and he says, well, what are you talking about? The Emancipation Proclamation was issued in the first gun fired at Fort Sumter. We have only let off a puff of wind about an established fact. And so even Seward recognized that black people had seized their own freedom before Lincoln ever made that official.
Oh, my. That makes sends chills up and down when you think about today, then, doesn't it?
And it's whole set of unsung Civil War heroes, and I found stories of many of these individuals who stood up and seized their freedom and fought very bravely against the Confederacy.
Yeah. There was a slave. You weren't supposed to have slavery in Washington, D.C., but you write about a slave who was being auctioned in D.C. Right at this time period. Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, it's very poignant, I think, that we tend, again, not to think of how slavery was so interwoven with many parts of American society, American government, including the capital of our country was very much a slave city. And literally, right as Abraham Lincoln is arriving in Washington to take the oath of office, there are men and women being sold at auction within almost literally a few hundred yards of the White House, just off of Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. So it was really slavery. I think that's symbolic of the fact that slavery was something that was right at the heart of America at this point.
Let's go back to phone calls. Charles is next in Southern Illinois. Hi, Charles.
I had a couple questions. First one, could you perhaps review why it was the North didn't just offer a cash settlement to buy out slavery and just obviate the need for the war? Never read much about how that was considered, if it was considered at all, or why it wasn't. Second question is, why would the South not be allowed the opportunity to leave? They weren't making any demands on the North. They weren't really aggressive. They just wanted to leave, somewhat akin to how the colonies wanted to leave Great Britain. The notion being that, well, the North was going to colonize or take over the South and force them into either subjugation or forced participation in the Union. And then finally, along the same vein, if the goal was to sustain the Union, which ostensibly it was, why was Sherman and the Army so, let's say, brutal to their future countrymen, or their reunited countrymen? And Sherman marched to the sea, destroyed so much in the South, because now that they've been reintegrated or became part of the Union again, they basically destroyed, I would say, a third to half of the productive power of the South, and just, you know, wreaking terrible devastation. Never made much sense to me. It was just the goal of military occupation and a reintegration of the South into the Union.
Those are three really big questions, and it would be easy to take up the next half hour or more with answering them. But let me give you I'll try to give short answers to them. So I'm sorry. So your first question was about why it was that the North didn't simply buy out the Southern slaveholders, and there were a couple of reasons for that. One was simply the enormous amount of value that those slaves represented. Lincoln himself, and in fact others at the time, North and South, calculated that value was $4 billion, which was an enormous amount of money when the entire annual budget of the federal government before the Civil War was, I think, something like $20 million. So it was just an expense that was inconceivable to people. And also the Southerners themselves were very unwilling to have this happen because they did not want free blacks living in their midst. And so even if these slaves had been liberated, then there would have been the question, first of all, of what to do with them. Do we send them over to Africa, where many of them would not want to go, which would be another enormous, enormous expense, and then deprives the South of its labor force, or leave them settled in the South, which Southerners were absolutely terrified by for many reasons. So I think that was really never anything that was even remotely on the table when the Civil War began. And in fact, the price of slaves was rising very steeply when the war began. And Southerners saw these men and women, as terrible as it is to say, investments that they didn't want to, quote-unquote, liquidate. Now, your second question about why the Union didn't simply let the South go, and wasn't it similar to the situation with the colonies in 1776? I think there's a very crucial difference to the colonies, and that is that the whole issue of the colonies in 1776 was that we did not have political representation in England. We were not part of that political system. We didn't have a stake in it. And so when we declared our independence, it was different from secession. In the instance of secession, what people were basically saying was that the democratic system of majority rule does not hold, that if any group disagrees with the majority vote, they can simply take their chips and leave the table. And I think Lincoln very rightly realized that this was something that could only lead to anarchy. In fact, it was even a form of almost terrorism against the democratic system. Democracy is impossible if you don't have majority rule. And in fact, the ironic thing is that I think the South would have ended up splitting apart very quickly as different states in the Confederacy decide they want to leave, as in fact happened with West Virginia. So I think when Lincoln said that winning this war was something that was needed so that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth, I think he understood that that was quite literally true. And finally, your question about Sherman's men. It was a very terrible time in the war, a very terrible time in American history. And I think that something that people lose sight of when they talk about Sherman is that the atrocities, terrible as it is to say, were very much on both sides in the war. When you read about what the Confederates were doing in places like Missouri, literally lining up dozens or in one instance even a couple of hundred Union civilians and shooting them in cold blood, or shooting captured colored soldiers, African-American soldiers in cold blood. Yes, there were terrible things that were done by both sides, as there always are in war, but I think, in fact, in terms of destroying the South's economy, it was really freeing the slaves that did much more for that than Sherman ever did, and for that the Confederates really only had themselves to blame.
There is something about this Civil War, and maybe I'm just saying this on the heels of having been deeply moved by our journey to Gettysburg recently, of looking out at that battlefield and having a guide whose grandfather had served in Gettysburg, and
wow,
reading books that describe this great mass of bodies, that the blood and the arms gone and the legs, and it entered. I had nightmares about it the next day. Mm. You just wonder why, as one of our listeners said, it would instantaneously make a pacifist of you just to think about it now. It's just hard to imagine on some very deep level, isn't it, Adam, that this happened in this country, and it started not that long ago, 150 years ago, and it was over slavery. It's just hard to put it all together how we could do this.
Yeah, it's really not that long ago when you come to think of it. And when you think about just what Americans were willing to do to one another at that moment, it's very shocking. You know, I just found some incredibly horrifying quotations from the press at that time, even from the very beginning of the war. I can read one to you.
Yes.
Now, when a writer, a Virginian, less than a month after Fort Sumter, writes of the North, "We will glut our carrion crows with their beastly carcasses. Yes, from the peaks of the Blue Ridge to Tidewater, we will strew our plains and leave their bleaching bones to enrich our soil."
Oh,
I mean, imagine saying that about anyone, let alone your fellow countrymen.
Oh, fellow countrymen.
Mm. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Charles, for the call. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
Another wonderful program. I was very surprised a few years back when I read one of these kind of the great ifs of history, and this is a little bit related to your previous caller. The point this person was making was that if the Union had just said to the South, "Okay, go," but any slave who gets to your northern or southern border, say the Mason-Dixon line, is free. So you will have a problem keeping your slaves under control. And also, you can come back into the Union, but you will have to come back as a free state, reapply for admission. And his argument was that the South was so poorly led and that their economy was really pretty fragile. They were essentially a banana republic, a one cash crop economy, and that they really, with terrible leadership, would have had a lot of fights among themselves, disintegrated quickly, and that within a fairly short period of time, they would have basically been reapplying for admission under the conditions that the North had established. And what surprised me, and why I'm really interested in particular to hear your opinion on this, sir, is that I then was talking with someone who was a history professor who said, "Oh, yeah, that was actually a fairly common historical perspective among historians in the late 19th century. And I said, "Really?" Because, you know, when I read this, yeah, it just came as a bolt from the blue. So
yeah,
what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think that what you're saying actually echoes what a lot of Southerners were saying at the time. You know, there was a lot of division within the South over whether or not to secede, and we tend to think of the Southern states as one sort of solid Confederate bloc, and that was definitely not the case. In fact, in many states, it was really more this sort of small political elite who favored secession, and even many of them were skeptical. There's one remark that I found that I really thought was very powerful from a Missourian, where he said, you know, "If we secede, the entire North will become Canada. In other words, as you said, if slaves cross the Mason-Dixon line, they'll be home free, where within the Union, Southerners could go to the North and recover their fugitive slaves. So he also said slavery will be more secure within the Union than without it. And I think that was absolutely right. You know, from the moment that the South seceded, the slave system began to crumble. And the sort of the irony is, you know, there's this famous speech that the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stephens, gave, the cornerstone speech, where he said the foundation of this Confederate Republic, its cornerstone rests upon the idea of slavery. Well, the irony is that as soon as that cornerstone began to crumble, that was the beginning of the end for the Confederacy. Now, I would disagree a bit with this idea that if the Southern states had been invited to come back into the Union as free states, that they would have embraced this. I really think that they were so attached to the institution of slavery that that would have been extremely far-fetched.
Thank you, Scott, for your call, as always. We go next to Steve in La Crosse. Hi, Steve.
Just wanted to point out that if your guest doesn't know it, there's a whole collection, about 65 or 70 letters that are online from the Wisconsin Historical Society from my, I don't know how many, great uncle who was killed in the Civil War, but his name was Adam Munzenberger.
And, great name, too.
Huh?
Yeah, I said that's a great name, too.
Yes, yes. He was German, obviously. Grew up in immigrated from Hesse in Germany. Mm. And nobody really seemed to know why he joined the Army in the first place. He was 32 years old, had four kids, a successful business, and he just up one day and joined the Army. Well, it turns out that why he did it was he was also Catholic, and his church was building a new church, and they needed the money for a new steeple. So he got the enlistment bonus, which I think was $500, and gave it to the church. And he actually left Milwaukee in 1862 and was captured at Gettysburg and died in Libby Prison in Richmond. But his letters are quite poignant. One of the interesting things was he was made the company clerk because he was the only one who could write and read German and English both.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
Mm. Yeah, not
a very interesting story, but the letters are very touching. He lost his business, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
His family moved from Milwaukee to La Crosse County, and he lost two kids during the war due to sickness.
I'm not familiar with that collection, but I'd love to know more about it. And in fact, if you would send me the link to it, you can just Google Adam Goodhart, and you'll find my email address pretty easily.
Great.
That way. But you know, it's interesting what you say about your ancestor being of German background, because this is another group that we don't hear much about traditionally when we talk about the Civil War. And in fact, they were incredibly important, especially in that build-up to the conflict. A lot of these German immigrants came over because they were escaping from the sort of backlash against the liberal revolutions of 1848 in Europe. And they came to America because they wanted to be in a land of freedom, and they brought these liberal politics with them. And they sure didn't want to be in a country that would cave into slavery. They were very strongly pro-Lincoln in the election of 1860. And in many places, they were sort of the first people to be ready really to stand up and fight. One of the stories that I tell in my book, in fact, is about one of these communities of German immigrants who organized themselves almost from the moment that Lincoln was elected, began drilling with rifles, and at the beginning of the war scored an incredible military coup before the rest of the Union really was kind of off the starting line. So the Germans just absolutely fascinate me, and I think there's been very little done about them. And in my book, I try to tell some of those stories as well.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk a little bit more about perceptions of blacks in this country at that time. A couple things are striking to me. One is still it wasn't very long ago. Two is that there were very few people in the North who accepted the fact that we're equal, that people are equal. And you write about the vast majority of white Americans on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line accepting without question the premise that blacks were inherently inferior and that the two races could never live together as equals. Some white Northerners even agreed with a common Southern sentiment that slavery was good for the Negro.
That's right. I think, you know, we lose track of the fact, for one thing, that Northerners did not actually, for the most part, know any African Americans, certainly not any enslaved African Americans. Northerners and Southerners did not really travel between the two sections, and so slaves in the South really just figured as abstractions until the war began. And I believe one of the greatest revolutions in the war came when these Union troops started marching through the South, and really the only friends they encountered as they groped their way through hostile territory were these African-American slaves rushing towards their armies and offering their services to help. And they realized these are men and women with their own life stories, with their own identities, and who really just, they want to be free. They want to be Americans. They're ready to serve our cause. They're not looking to sort of rise up and massacre all of the white people in vengeance. So that in itself was an enormous revolution that began in the very first months of the war and that has been largely forgotten today.
Mm. I am so moved. Well, I'm always moved by Abraham Lincoln. I just love the man, and I feel like we carried him from the Midwest to Washington, and that he is appreciated and so much a part of the national scene. But I love the story about Lincoln inviting Frederick Douglass to the White House after the second inaugural and asking his opinion of the speech and saying to him that yours is the opinion that I value most. And when you say what you just said, and I remember that, what that meant, it's a fairly big thing.
Yes, and of course Lincoln's views on race and his statements on race have been debated endlessly ever since that time, and even Frederick Douglass himself after the war spoke of the complications of Lincoln's views, but Douglass ultimately embraced Lincoln as a hero. No doubt they'll be debated for many generations to come, mm-hmm. But I'm somebody who tends to fall more on the side of believing that Lincoln was someone who hated slavery, who even was very skeptical of the idea of white supremacy, but was also a very canny politician in many ways, and said what he needed to say in order to get elected, as many politicians do in this day, just like in that. But there's a fascinating letter that Lincoln wrote to one of his only really close bosom friends in the course of his life, a man named Jonathan Speed. A very private letter from 1855, when the Know-Nothing movement, anti-immigrants, anti-Catholic, was really booming. And Lincoln says, you know, we began in this country with the idea that all men are created equal. And then it became all men are created equal except for the Negro. And now it's becoming all men are created except for the Negro, the immigrants, and the Catholics. And he said, if things go any further in this country, I might as well move to some place like Russia, where we can take our despotism unadulterated with hypocrisy. Isn't that incredible?
That is incredible. You said so many things that were incredible. You can spend your lifetime just going over them. Connie, let's go to Connie in Arcadia. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I have a couple questions. First of all, I think I'm hearing you say that the Civil War was all about slavery. I've heard sometimes it's said that it was started mainly to save the Union, and that slavery became prominent only later. And I wondered if you'd just comment on that.
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And I think what that comes out of is that people today have a hard time sort of imagining that being against slavery and being for abolition could be two different things. But in fact, that was the case, that there were many, many people in the North, probably by this point a majority of Northerners, believed that the slave system was wrong. They were tired of these compromises where they continued to yield political ground to the South. They were tired of being asked to sort of abet and accept this slave system. They weren't free to force abolition. They weren't ready to force abolition on the South, but they did want to draw a line in the sand and say, we are not ready to go any further. And I think it was the Southern recognition of that really panicked many Southerners and made them withdraw from the Union. You know, many people talk about the issue of states' rights. Well, really the only rights that you see Southerners discussing in 1860 and 61 were rights that had to do with the right to own slaves. They really weren't talking about anything else. So Yes, it was a war to save the Union, but it was a war to save a particular kind of union, a union that was not going to accommodate slavery anymore. And if it had been anything else, they would have simply accepted another set of compromises to keep the South in the Union.
Adam Goodhart is our guest. His book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Kathleen Mavourneen, awake from thy slumbers. The blue mountains glow in the sun's golden light. Ah, where is the spell that once hung on my numbers? Arise in thy beauty, thou star of my night. Mavourneen, Mavourneen, my sad tears are falling, to think that from Erin and thee I must part. It may be for years, and it may be forever, then why art thou silent, thou voice of my heart?
1861 is the book we're talking about, The Civil War Awakening. Adam Goodhart is our guest. It may be for years or it may be forever. There's something I want to talk about, because it seems to me as though you can't take in this event, this kind of event, the Civil War, without thinking of these huge, deep, profound ideas. And you write, Adam, that 1861 was like 1776, and still is. It's not just a year, but an idea. And Walt Whitman understood this. Walt Whitman figures prominently in your book, and he does in any discussion of the Civil War and in any attempt to understand all the emotions and the idea of patriotism and union and all of that. You got to read Whitman because you have to read poetry or a discussion of what that big idea is when you think about the Civil War, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And, you know, one of the great pleasures of studying that moment and writing about that moment, and I think one of the reasons that we continue to be fascinated with it, is just what incredible literature there is that comes
yes.
out of that time. And not only poets like Walt Whitman, but it almost seems like every individual private in the Union Confederate armies was capable of writing just this incredible prose sometimes. It was sort of a moment, I think, in the history of our country when literacy had become very widespread, but people also hadn't sort of had their brains filled with such mass culture that they were out of touch with that very individual, powerful expression. And so it's a fantastic moment. And in researching my book, there were just so many incredible things that people said that the only question was really sort of what to include and what not to. And also, you know, when you play that beautiful song, there's such great music that comes out of that period and visual art. The photography is amazing. So I think that there's a certain power in just a good story and in music and an art that has its own fascination for us and that helps to explain why we're so endlessly interested in that mm-hmm. moment and why that moment is so endlessly fascinating to historians and why there can always be a new story. You know, people have asked me, well, with 75,000 books already out about the Civil War, that's more than one book for each day since the Civil War ended, why write another one? And I say this story is so incredible that it can be always retold. It's
yes.
like the Iliad
yes.
or the Odyssey or the stories of the Bible.
And mm-hmm.
I knew when I went back to tell that story that there would be a new way to tell it.
Yeah.
And Whitman certainly is part of that story too. He was, you know, the great poets are prophets, and Whitman was a prophet who understood a lot of great truths of this war really almost from the moment the first shots were fired.
Jim in Pleasant Prairie, our next caller. Hi, Jim. Hello, Jim. Jim's not there. Jan from Verona. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. I started listening to your program right in my car, and then I had to come in the house, and I lost half of it. I'm really sorry, because it's a wonderful program this morning. I have a question for your caller, for your guest. What was the European reaction to the Civil War in the United States? Were they for it, against it? divided, or did they think to themselves, is this your comeuppance for being so revolutionary from the Revolutionary War?
Yeah. There was a lot of division, and everyone was very aware of this war being played out on the world stage. So there was division between these European countries because there were many people who would have been just as happy to see this as you said, the sort of upstart American republic get its due. And the Confederacy really counted on the European nations to support it. They believed that by choking off the supply of cotton to Europe, or threatening to choke off the supply of cotton to Europe, they would bring Europe in on the side of the Confederacy. But in fact, you know, so many Europeans by this point, especially in England, which was really the keystone to European public opinion, of course, were strongly anti-slavery, including Queen Victoria and Prince Albert themselves, that I really think it was never terribly likely that a country like England was going to come in on the side of a republic that was founded on the idea of slavery, a nation that was founded on the idea of slavery. So I think that was a sort of a forlorn hope of the Confederates from the very beginning of the war.
Thank you very much, Jan, for the call. Craig in Waukesha, hi.
Hi, my name is I'm Craig, and I'm descendant of several Civil War soldiers, and I even got letters to prove it. But my main point is that little people do realize that a number of women were documented as having disguised themselves as Union soldiers and fought. There was a woman who was named Jenny Hodges, who enlisted in the 95th Illinois Infantry as Albert D. Cashier. She wasn't even discovered until years later. And there are a number of documented instances of women fighting in battles, and some will never even be known because apparently, from what I've read, that after the Battle of Gettysburg, Union burial details were burying the dead from Pickett's Charge. When they went to bury the body of one particular rebel private, they discovered to their horror that it was a woman.
Adam.
This is something that I think, again, has been lost to touch with in the war, the way that women were heroes, and not just the ones who put on soldiers' uniforms, but those who stayed on the home front, black women and white women. And I've tried to bring their stories out in my book. There are some incredible heroic women. I probably don't have time to tell their stories, but an incredibly heroic children as well. This was not just a war that was about a bunch of gentlemen in blue and gray uniforms going out onto some battlefield. This was a war in which many, many Americans of every race and every sex and age were heroes in a real way.
Mm-hmm. And when did this become endlessly fascinating to you? It's absorbed, and I'm glad it has, because we're the beneficiaries of this, a great deal of your life.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm not one of those sort of Civil War nerds who's been, you know, researching. And in fact, even today, if you ask me, you know, what was General Meade's strategy exactly at Gettysburg, I'll sort of give you a blank look. And but I've always been fascinated with these moments in history when everything changes.
Yes,
overnight.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
Part of it, actually, I think, had to do with my experience, strangely enough, on 9/11. I was here in Washington, and I remember leaving my house and coming out onto 16th Street, just north of the White House, seeing these crowds of people standing and looking at the column of smoke rising from the Pentagon and saying to each other, the world is never going to be the same again. And that's what it was like in 1861. I don't think I would have appreciated that until that moment. So I think every generation can understand the Civil War in its own new way.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you're going to be – we have people who have messages for you that are probably best for you to read. Give us that. Is it adamgoodhart.com for them to write to you? Or
actually, if they write to agoodhart2@washcall, that's for washingtoncollege.edu, or if they just Google my name and
okay.
Washington College, they'll find my address pretty easily. But I love to hear from listeners. I love to hear from readers of my book. It's a great thing about writing a book in this day and age,
sure,
that you can get into these conversations with people. So please, I'd love to hear from readers.
Okay. And you will be right now, I imagine, you're hopping from here to the newyorktimes.com
to do
a live chat. You will
That's
have
right.
a very busy day, I'm sure, and in year
day.
As we celebrate the years of the Civil War. Thank you so much, Adam, for being with us.
This was just a pleasure. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Adam. Adam Goodhart, his book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening, and it is well worth your read. It's just very, very well done. He is a historian, a journalist, and a travel writer. His articles have appeared in National Geographic, Outsider, Smithsonian, The Atlantic, and The New York Times, among many others. And he's also a regular columnist for The New York Times Civil War blog, which, as we begin commemorations now of many events of the Civil War during the sesquicentennial, you may want to go to that blog because it's worth seeing. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and for producing. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for putting together music and answering phone calls and getting this guest. It was a good hour. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9:00.